Blog Talk Radio.
We must honor their pain. I once heard author Pete Hamill say that of our ancestors' sufferings. Honor their pain. I've never forgotten that.
Slumber, my darling, thy mother is near, guarding thy dreams from all terror and fear.
My grandmother, Florence Gorman, gave birth to 5 daughters, but within a few hours of the middle child's birth, my grandparents were shocked by what they saw. Their baby's wraps were soaked in blood. My grandfather called for the doctor who delivered the baby. It was too late. He pronounced Florence dead. He was, however, vague as to the cause of her death. The undertaker wasn't. The baby's umbilical cord was cut too short, he said. My grandfather walked from the family's Brooklyn apartment on Atlantic Avenue to nearby St. Rita's Roman Catholic Church to arrange the baby's funeral service. The priest explained, however, that a Catholic funeral service wasn't possible. The baby hadn't been baptized. Embodied with original sin, which only baptism could cleanse from her soul, Florence could not be buried in consecrated ground. One night, while viewing a family interment list, I called my mother and asked where her sister was buried. My mother said the only thing she knew was that Florence wasn't with her mother and father at St. John's Cemetery. I began a search and learned that Florence died at 6 a.m. on October 1st, 1925. The cause of death is recorded as hemorrhagic disease of the newly born. I discovered that Florence was buried at Mount Olivet, a non-sectarian cemetery in Maspeth, Queens. I drove to the cemetery and visited the main office. A clerk sifted through the old burial records. He located Florence's name. She was buried at Hillside 4A. A staff member drove me through the rolling terrain, past old maple trees and over hills that afford sweeping views of the New York skyline. But the terrain changed as we neared a distant section of the cemetery. "She's over there," he said. Florence was buried in an unmarked grave on a hill, alongside a fence separated from her parents for sins neither she nor her mother and father had committed. How, I wondered, could my grandmother ever attend a Catholic service again? She didn't, my mother said, except for weddings and first communions. Your grandmother once said they can bury gangsters in a Catholic cemetery, but they can't bury a little baby because of some rule. On September 10th, 1931, Salvatore Maranzano, the boss of the New York Mafia, was shot and stabbed on orders of Lucky Luciano. Maranzano is buried at St. John's Cemetery, a few yards from my grandparents. I couldn't imagine how or why my grandfather, a man who wouldn't condone the mildest familial slight, would acquiesce in this matter. I learned that my grandfather, a compassionate and caring man, the son of an Irish immigrant, was dealing with a force he probably never considered. For hundreds of years, the British controlled Ireland. The rule was harsh and intended to eliminate the Catholic clergy and curtail Catholic worship. But in many ways, their rule and the penal laws strengthened Irish resolve, reinforcing the ties between Irish Catholics and the Vatican. The harsh rules fostered secrecy and silence, and many Catholics were forced to practice their religion at secret masses. And although the church was the one source of refuge, the grim theology of original sin exerted its mighty grasp on Ireland's people. Catholics were taught that when Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, their sin caused them to lose their innocence, dooming them to misery and death. The stain of original sin could only be removed by the sacrament of baptism. Without it, the chance of entering heaven, they were told, is non-existent. Born in sin, combined with the fact that their captors shamed them into believing they were an inferior species, the Irish spirit was crippled. Between 1845 and 1851, the famine Irish began arriving in New York City. Bishop John Hughes, an Irish immigrant, recognized their spiritual needs and began ordering the building of churches. The first, St. Bridget, located on Manhattan's Lower East Side, was completed in 1849. St. Patrick's and many more followed. The church provided community, values, and ethnic identity. But there was a trade-off. The church kept the rigid rules and the strict theology of original sin, and the priests, as they had in Ireland, retained their status and importance. I returned to Florence's grave. I gathered some dirt and poured it into a small bag. I thought of St. Augustine, a Catholic scholar and theologian who said, "Even if there were men and nothing but original sin, it would be sufficient for their condemnation." Original sin, the belief that we are born tainted, shame born of oppression, and the unquestioned word of a priest held sway over my grandfather in a way that I would have imagined impossible. I returned to the spot where my grandparents are buried. I sprinkled the dirt over their grave. Florence was home where she belongs. I can't imagine how my grandparents must have felt. I hope I've honored their pain. I did the best I could.
Charles R. Hale was born, raised, and educated in New York. He is the co-founder of the Irish American Writers and Artists Salon. He has a master in cultural history and has had a number of his family and ancestral history essays published in literary magazines. He has now gathered his stories in a multimedia performance which incorporates voice, photos, music, and lab performances. Please welcome him to the show.
Hi, Charles. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, I love listening to that video. Your voice is incredible. It's perfect for that kind of thing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Before we get started, can you tell everybody how to find you?
Well, I have a blog, and the name of the blog, the name of the blog is right now The Salon. However, the tag is Stories Connect Love Heals, and that's one word, .com. And if they go to storiesconnectloveheals.com, they'll get to my blog site.
And that's also on the front of the show if anybody wants to find it. Can you tell us a little more about yourself?
Okay. Well, basically, my background, for years I was in a financial business for a long, long time. And I was able to retire from that fairly young. And from that point on, I spent lots of time researching family history, researching New York City history. I finished my master's later in life in my 50s. And I today now work on films. I help people in the artistic field with our salons, trying to get younger and older people together to let them spread their work and hopefully create some collaboration between them. So I've become pretty busy in the arts, and it's probably something I was interested in as a young age, but when I was growing up, the arts, no one was involved in the arts. I mean, it was basically find a job and make some money, and I did that for years, and then I spread out from there. So that's a little bit of the background.
Now, what is, when you say a master in cultural history, what type of things does that cover?
Well, what I, originally I had intended to do a master's, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to be in psychology or in leadership or human growth or something like that, human development. And cultural history is basically what happened was I became very interested in my family in 19th century New York. They were in Brooklyn and Manhattan. And the more I started researching them, the more I realized I wanted to understand about their lives. So I started studying their culture, how they lived and what they were surrounded by, the music, theater, everything I could find about their culture. So I ended up doing a master's in cultural history with a specialty in Irish-American culture in New York City in the 19th century.
And one thing I noticed about all your videos is not only the rich history in them, but the music as well. So do you have a sense of knowledge of music, or how are you locating these songs in these videos?
When I was a kid, when everyone was watching TV, I was always listening to the radio.
Okay.
So I listened to a lot of music, but in addition to that, I was really lucky because when I was in grammar school, I used to walk to school and I could come home for lunch. And my mother, who was very interested in music, particularly music of the 30s and 40s, and I'm not sure why she did this, but she started buying some classical music albums. And when I'd come home for lunch, she would play classical music. And I developed a great interest in classical music at an early age. Now, I was an athletic kid who was very uninterested in school, and so it was a little bizarre that I had this interest in classical music growing up in New York City. But as I got older, going to my 20s, and I listened to a lot of the stuff that everyone else did, the typical 60s and 70s music,
right.
I started going to a lot of jazz clubs. So I began going to lots of jazz clubs and lots of classical concerts. So I just developed a great interest in a number of forms of music, but particularly those two. And it's helped me now when I'm writing, all of a sudden something will come to me, some music that feels right.
Right.
And that's typically how I do it.
Yeah, you can definitely tell you have a sense of knowledge just by the way you match the songs and the feeling in the videos. I was very impressed with that. And you could tell it wasn't mainstream. That you had a deeper knowledge than most people.
Well, I don't know every song. I remember I took a class in classical music when I was in my early 20s. A fellow had a very popular radio station of classical music back then, and he said if he had a dime for every piece of classical music he'd never heard, he'd be a very wealthy man. So there's so much I don't know. However, I've got enough of a background where I can jump from there. I can listen to, I'll get a feeling like, oh, the music of Mozart will work here. Well, what piece? And I may have one or two in mind. And then I'll start listening to more Mozart music, and then I'll find something I have, some sonata or something I haven't heard or I can't remember hearing. And so at least I know where to go. And the same thing with jazz. You know, I know the feeling if I want to hear Coltrane or Miles Davis. You know, it's like I know the sound I want. I know the sound of the trumpet I want. And, you know, I just go with it. And, I think people like that. At least I hope they do.
Oh, yeah, it definitely creates a whole other layer to the story that you're telling. An important layer, too, because it brings the energy into it of what you're trying to create. One thing I did want to find out more is your childhood. Let's start with there, because a lot of times people start at the original video, and I believe that the story begins way before the project. So tell us how you got such a sense of history that you would want to honor this much of your family's history.
Well, You know, I come from a long line of storytellers. My grandfathers were both very, very different types, but they were really good storytellers, and so was my father. And so what happened, you know, I probably didn't, I couldn't articulate this when I was younger. I can now. I wanted to get a sense of who I was, not only from a psychological standpoint, but how has culture, how has my family's culture, how have their experiences helped create who I am?
Exactly.
So, you know, yeah, so I began looking a lot into their past. So a lot of what I do is I try to find a little kernel of or a little seed, even a few words, and I've actually done that. There were some words. It was a sentence that carried through my family for years, and I researched. I tried to find out what that was, and I think I learned. And by doing that, I really, and used the word before when you and I were talking empathic, it's like getting in their space. You know, how do I get, you know, how do I breathe of their space and time? And I called one of my videos that. So a lot of it is I've just always had this feeling that I needed to know more. I'll give you the real thing. This really struck me when I was 13 years old. I was sitting in a Catholic instruction class called confraternity back then, and I never paid attention. I was looking out the window. I couldn't wait to get out. I wanted to play baseball or football or something. And all of a sudden, the nun who was teaching the course said, "We are as one. We are as one. We are each other in our joy and suffering," or something to that effect. And that really struck me. We are one. We are of each other in our joys and suffering. And it always stayed with me, and I never really knew exactly what that meant until I got a little older, and then I learned that it was something that St. Augustine had said related to the saints Peter and Paul, that even though they died at different times, they were of one and so on. So a lot of it to me is that how are we one, and how do I get to understand and live the joys and sufferings of others? So I'm rambling a little bit, but that gives you a little bit of a sense.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. Do you do that a lot where one line sticks with you and becomes the whole journey?
Absolutely. The line I mentioned, it sounds a little bizarre when I say it to you, but my mother told me that my grandmother always regretted that she had said to her mother, when my grandmother was about 10 years old, she said to her mother that her face looks like a pig's face. And I couldn't imagine what that was about, because I have a picture of my great-grandmother who was very nice-looking, and why would my grandmother say that? Well, what I learned was that my great-grandmother died of an abscess in her mouth. And I've gotten the death certificate that indicates her whole face was swollen, her whole body. She had so many different ailments as a result of that, that I think what happened was my grandmother said that to her as she suffered through this and eventually died of it. And that was an amazing journey for me, figuring out why would my grandmother ever say to her mother, "You look like a pig."
Right.
So, yeah, it's those kinds of things. I mean, I have a number of them that were said to me that I've really made stories out of, that my grandfather in the reform school, and all these little things. And it's amazing how there's no such thing as a word that doesn't have meaning. I mean, if a word passes through or sentence a family for years, there's value in that. There's a reason these things pass forward, right? So, yes, the answer is yes. I'm always looking for a little something like that.
Now, I definitely believe we're strongly influenced by our past. Like, I'd even commented the other day, there's so many things within our life that exist that we have no knowledge of where its origin is. So what you're doing is extremely valuable to give a true history to your family. Do they value it as much as you do?
Everybody's different. I have two sisters. One is very much interested in what I'm doing, and the other one, her comment is often, "Oh, that's nice." So, and then it really varies. I have some who hang on every word I do and watch the videos and read everything and anything I learn they want to know. And then there are others who are at the absolute other end where, you know, if they didn't know, they wouldn't care.
Right.
You know, so it's, you know, it spans the spectrum. My son, I have one son, and he's pretty interested in this, and he asks me lots of questions, and he always wants to see the videos, and he actually is very creative, so sometimes he'll help me with the videos, and it's nice. I mean, it's nice to have, you know, my son interested. Having only one child, if you weren't interested, I might feel that this stuff would go nowhere, you know?
Right.
But at least I know that he can carry this on.
And that's extremely valuable. Now, you must spend an incredible amount of time researching things.
I sure do. I mean, I've been to Ireland a number of times, and I've researched a number of things in archives over there, in Dublin, and in towns where my family's from. I've spent many, many hours in New York archives, in the public library, in the U.S. archives, you name it. I've had lots of time in a municipal building where the death, birth, marriage certificates are. I can't tell you how many reels of tape I've spun through, you know, hours, maybe looking for one little piece of information. And one mystery leads to the next. You know, sometimes
right.
what I'll find, I mean, I found one. I knew my grandmother's date of birth was June 23rd, 1903, and I couldn't find her death certificate or a birth certificate. And I was sitting next to a genealogist, and she said, well, was she the firstborn, thinking that, you know, they were embarrassed, they changed the date because maybe they weren't married when she was conceived. And
right.
I said, no, she was the last child, I don't understand. And I kept looking, and I found that her birthday was April 30th, and I couldn't figure it out. I found her baptismal certificate, and she was baptized in early July. And I called up a cousin of mine who used to be a nun, and I said, let me run this by you. Might they have gone to get her baptized when they didn't want to say she was born April 30th because they would have been embarrassed they had waited so long? So they'd said, all right, she was born June 23rd. And my cousin said, that's probably accurate. Back then, people were shamed into this, that, and whatever. So my grandmother and my mother's sisters went through their entire life thinking my grandmother's date of birth was June 23rd. It was April 30th. It happened to be my other grandmother's birthday, too.
Ah.
So, but you never know. So you find these things, and you can imagine how people were conducting their lives by learning that little piece. Wow.
Oh,
they really ashamed to go and do that. Or, you know, what else could be the reason? They had no idea. So, yeah, it's amazing what you come up with when you do these searches. That's happened to me over and over and over.
Yeah, but there has to be something within you that's able to be drawn almost to this, because you have a sense of, like, hunger to figure things out, where other people may see the same thing and it just blow right past them.
You know, you're right, that does happen, and what is it in me that does that? You know, it's kind of, what's the word? Ineffable. I mean, I can't explain it. I don't know. It's just what I feel. And, you know, I'm just pulled toward that.
Right.
You know, I can't give you a good explanation. I know this is not a great analogy, but it's like porno. You know it when you see it. I know it when I feel it. You know, and I feel, you know, somebody will say something or I'll read something, and it's like, I have to pursue that.
Right.
It's
just a gut feeling that.
A great example of that would be, and I don't know if you watched it. It was the one called "Breathing of an Ancestor, Space and Time,"
yeah.
Where I found the fire logs, and
How incredible is that?
It's amazing. I mean, I didn't even know they existed. It was a chance, a word that somebody said. I said, "Boy, you have the records of all the fires in the firehouse for the last 100 years, yeah, and I was able to go into the basement.
I'm surprised you're still not sitting there reading those. That's like Christmas to you, isn't it?
And then I would go take that. I would read about a fire, and then I would go to the New York Times and the Daily News and read the story.
Yeah.
And then imagine my grandfather at the fire. You know, so there's just something. When I was in college, as I said, I was an okay student because I was taking courses I wasn't interested in. But I'd often go to the library and pick out an event like when Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic in 1927. I was always captivated by that because my father was born when that was happening. And so sitting there reading how Lindbergh did that, knowing that my grandparents and, you know, were having my father, and my father was born then, there was just something about that gave me a better understanding of their lives. So I was always pulled toward something like that.
So history to you is alive. Where other people dead and cold, it's alive to you and all around us.
That's a great way to say it, and what I've often said and often wondered is, if we could be taught history from a personal level, not a huge historical level, people would probably be much more interested. You know, it's like, well, what was going on in your family's life when World War II started? Where did they live, and what was the impact? Did somebody get drafted? Where did they go? Then all of a sudden, it's personalized.
It becomes alive.
Exactly. So that's a good way to say that.
Yeah. And what happened in Ireland and directly impacts New York's history in more ways than people will ever understand.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's saturated in it. Yeah.
What's that?
It's definitely saturated in the Irish history.
Well, there were so many people who came from Ireland in the 19th century, particularly in New York. I mean, New York was 25% Irish in 1860, so it, you know, it really had a big impact.
And there was a massive increase in people coming from Ireland in, like, 1850s and on.
Well, the famine, the famous famine, the Great Famine, although there were a number of famines before and after that, was really from about 1846 to 1851. And so you had this enormous influx into New York of really run-down, sick, starving, in many cases illiterate farmers. I mean, these little tenant farmers who, you know, and all of a sudden they show up dressed strangely, many of them sick, half dead after the trip over, showing up by the thousands and thousands every day on the shores of Manhattan. It must have been incredible.
Wow. And it doesn't take long for the ships to show up with that kind of numbers before they were literally everywhere. Now, there were a lot of laws in place against them at the time.
There were a lot of laws against them, the penal laws in Ireland.
Yeah, but actual laws here where they could only do the dangerous jobs. They weren't allowed to, like, that's why there's so many police and firemen. Is because they were only allowed to do certain jobs, the dangerous jobs other people didn't want to do.
Well, they were very discriminated against, so yeah, they did take whatever they could get. I mean, if you search through death certificates, you'll see that everybody, so many of them were laborers, and what is a laborer? A laborer would be often the junkiest, rottenest job.
Right.
You know, carpet, garbage, you know, they worked on the ships. They cleaned the streets. I mean, they really did take the most miserable jobs. What really got the Irish through, to a large degree, I think, is that they became organized quickly. They became organized in the saloons. They were good organizers. They were very political. They spoke well. They could get people together. And within a short period of time, they were really running, very short period of time, they were running the city. It's an amazing story, and they had it very difficult. Any immigrant group, you know, I have a lot of empathy to immigrant groups because I know my family narrative, and I think if people had a better understanding of their family narrative, how they actually, the family developed, there'd be a lot more consideration and concern for immigrant groups who come after. And
I think
you know, maybe we're getting off target here, but I'm one who thinks that immigrants are immensely important to the culture and fabric of a country because it's the confluence of culture that often right. art to me is a music is a classic example of the immigrants in the 1930s were children of immigrants writing these wonderful songs in the American Songbook, and then the black musicians from the South and the Midwest coming here and playing those, and then all of a sudden you had jazz. It's a classic example of cultures coming together and creating something wonderful. So I think it's very important.
Oh, definitely. I agree with you completely on that. Let's talk about how the death of Baby Florence came to exist. How did you find out about this?
I was actually, when you and I first decided we would do this, I was thinking, when did I originally learn that? My grandmother died when I was 14. I don't think I knew it before that. I probably learned it in my late teens. And it was I said to my mother something like, well, you and your three sisters. And my mother said, well, I had four sisters. And I was, what do you mean you had four sisters? She said, well, one died. And here's the story I knew, what she told me, is one died shortly after she was born. When the doctor cut the baby's umbilical cord too short, she died. My grandfather walked down to the church to arrange a Catholic funeral, and he had just buried his father a year or two earlier, so they had a family plot.
Yep.
And the church asked my grandfather, was the baby baptized? Well, lay people can baptize a baby, and my grandfather said, yes, he did it. And the priest said, was she dead or alive? And my grandfather said, I don't know. And he said, well, if you don't know, she can't be buried in consecrated ground. And that was the story that we knew for years and years and years. And then about 10, 15 years ago, I said to my mother, it just struck me one day, where is the baby buried? And my mother said, I have no idea. So I knew when she was born between these two sisters, and I started doing some research, and I found that I found where she was buried. And it had an enormous impact on me. She was buried, as you can see in the video, in a non-sectarian cemetery off to the side along a fence.
Right.
Where they buried stillborns and unbaptized children and children who were paupers. They had a section of the cemetery where you didn't have to pay. And that's where she was. And so it was that. It was actually leaving there in the car that day, I had this enormous wave of sadness and depression come over me, and I knew I had to do something. So that was really how the whole thing started. It was just, an offhand question to my mother, where's the baby buried?
So you have to be extremely good at understanding the process of things in order to find all this. You have to understand that somewhere it has to be written, and how to find that and how to connect it all together. That's a very detailed process to do.
I guess I just let it flow. I mean, my attitude was, just one step, taking a step and then taking the next one. I mean, for instance, there were lots of obstacles along the way. When I found where the baby was buried, and then my grandparents were buried in a cemetery not too far away, when I determined, what could I do? We didn't know where the baby was buried. You couldn't disinter. There was nothing there. There was no exact site. Well, how do I honor my grandparents? How do I honor their pain? And when I went to the cemetery where they're buried, I looked at the stone, and there was room on the stone for the name of the baby. So I went to the cemetery director, and I said, look, here's the story. I'd like to get the baby's name on there. This is kind of funny, actually. And they said, well, okay, the first thing you have to do is prove your relationship to the owner of the grave. Well, that was my grandmother. And I said, all right, get your mother. You got to get your, and since it was in your grandmother's maiden name, you have to show that she was married, and then get your mother's birth certificate and put this all together. She said, okay. So my mother tells me when my grandparents were married, and we go down to the church in Brooklyn, and we can't find it. But we find it. It was a year later than we thought, and my mother's first sister was born 5 months after they were married. So
anybody researching, it's a little tricky sometimes. Yeah.
But they were all alive at the time. My mother said, whatever you do, don't tell my sister. I said, she's 80 years old now. Okay, she not tell her. So I never told her that they lied about my grandparents' birthday for all those years. So anyway, it was all about following that process. And, you know, it was just like one step led to another, led to another. And then finally, I went to a stone cutter, and it cost me, I think, $200 to get it on. I wrote to all my cousins, and I said, if anybody would like to contribute $5 or $10, be part of this. And a lot of them did because they wanted to feel they were involved.
Right.
This moved me almost a
few years
saying this. So, yeah, it's an amazing. And then what happened after this is that's when I published this, I started getting calls and emails from people in Ireland. And I didn't realize how big a story this is in Ireland. It's an amazing story.
Right.
It happened all the time there.
Yeah.
All the time.
The children in Ireland were a target in so many different ways. And so I could definitely see, as soon as I saw this video, I knew that it would touch a lot of the abuse and stuff that happened there.
Oh, geez.
With
I've gotten
women
calls from archaeologists, from people working in cemeteries. I got one thing after another. I really did. It was really an eye-opener for me. I had no idea that this was just common practice in Ireland and done all the time. I mean, I knew that, you know, churches denied burial of the unbaptized. I didn't realize how prevalent this was in Ireland. And now there's such a big voice amongst the people who suffered through this, trying to determine where their child was buried and, you know, trying to get, I hate the word closure, using the word closure all the time, but there was something about, you know, understanding the connection and where that child was that had value to these people. So it was an amazing journey for me, that's for sure.
Yeah, the unwed mothers in Ireland, they were under attack in so many different ways. So there has to be so many stories of this over there. And to think that a child is impure from birth, to me, is an insane concept to begin with. So can you tell us a little bit about the concept of original sin?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I was growing up, I studied what was called the Baltimore Catechism. And that was really what you learned and what you read to give you what Catholicism was all about. And basically, you know, and I had looked this up when I first started researching, you know, what was this whole thing about original sin exactly, you know, what was the power of it? And basically what, you know, I learned back then, as all Catholics did, is that when Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, their sin caused them to lose their innocence and holiness, and they were doomed to misery and death. And we, as their children, inherited that sin and punishment, and it was called original sin. And every child is born with that stain at conception, and if it's not removed, the child can't enter the kingdom of heaven. And the only way it can be removed is through the sacrament of baptism. So everyone is born with it, and the only way it can be gotten rid of is through, as I said, baptism, and thus there is no chance of entering heaven. So the person is actually proscribed from a funeral service because of this. And, you know, when I read that, when I went back and looked at what they had actually written, you know, it was like mind-boggling thinking this, that, as you say, this child, this seven-hour child, would be denied burial. I mean, what, you know, because if someone is somebody, I mean, I think it may come from Augustine in the 4th or 5th century, who basically said that a man cannot move on to heaven if he is without, you know, with the stain of sin. So this whole thing was a man-made rule.
Right.
And my grandmother said it the best, and it's in the video there, where the only time my mother ever heard her talk about it, or one of the few times, was when some hoodlum was being buried in the cemetery, and the cars are going by, and my mother and grandmother said they can bury some bum in the cemetery, but they can't bury my baby because she has the stain of original sin.
Exactly.
So you know, that's kind of where it comes from. And there was a pope, I think it was Pope Leo the Great, who in the 5th century, around the same time of Augustine, determined that not only couldn't they have a Catholic burial service, but I think he was the one that determined you couldn't bury them in consecrated ground. So this was something that went for a long time. I must say that I think the church has changed now, and I think it was in the early 1980s where if the parents intended the child to be baptized, the child can be buried in consecrated ground. So they did relent, I guess, through pressure on that one.
So, yeah, but, you know, you're still saying the child is impure to begin with, which that concept is flawed in my mind. So it's like, thanks for bending the rule that I think is crazy to begin with. But
well, a friend
for that.
Of mine, my business partner was, we're not partners anymore, but he used to say to me, now, listen, if you guys were Jews, someone would have cut a deal. I said, you're probably right. You know, it's like everybody made a deal, you know. I said, well, and it was really funny because I was talking to another friend of mine who's Jewish, and when he saw this video, he thought I was disrespecting my grandfather. He said, why didn't your grandfather step up? And I said, you don't understand what to be a Catholic back then. The priest's word was gospel. That was it. You walked away.
Yeah, you can't. There was nothing to step up to because all your jobs, your whole intermingling with society, all of it was intertwined. So if you stepped up against it, literally your family won't eat.
Well, you would have problems. There's no, you know, I don't know what the consequences for him would have been back then, but it was something I don't even think. And my grandfather was the most fearless man I ever met in my life. He had a horrible childhood. He was a very tough guy. He was very, very family-oriented. You couldn't say boo about his family. So the idea that he would go to a priest and walk away says to me the power was beyond belief.
Yes.
The parish priest's power was beyond belief.
And you're saying your grandfather came from Ireland, or did your great grandfather?
My great grandfather did. My great grandfather came right before Ellis Island was open in 1891, and then my grandfather was born in 1901. So he was born in Manhattan.
Yeah, and the children's education at that time, and well into like the 80s and so, was very brutal in a lot of places. So there's no telling
what his education was, but what's that? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Are you talking about the education in Ireland or here?
Yeah, in Ireland.
Yeah, I don't know as much about that as I do about New York, the educational system, but I'm sure, they were really very tough on kids. Because I think that same thing came here. You know, this real strictness, and particularly if you were in a parochial school.
Yeah, I interviewed a lot of people from industrial schools in Ireland, and it was as brutal as you can get.
Well, I know some people who attended them there, and even in the 20th century, and they were really, really, a horror.
Yeah.
And in fact, a poet, Connie Roberts, who won the Patrick Kavanagh Poet of the Year Award in Ireland for 2010, I know her pretty well, and she was brought up in an orphanage, and a lot of her poetry is about the difficulty of her life being brought up. And one day I said to her, why don't you write a memoir? And she said, no, this is the way I work through it, it's poetry. She said, I couldn't write directly about it, it's too painful. So she writes poetry about it, but and the amazing thing is when she saw my baby Florence story, she told me that her foster mother, and she didn't know this until she read that story, because her foster mother was here visiting her in the States from Ireland, and she said, why don't we watch this video that this friend of mine did about the death of the baby? And her foster mother had never told her this, but she had gone through the experience of losing an unbaptized child, and she didn't know where she was buried. And it was the first time that Connie had learned of this, and the first time her mother had ever spoken about it.
Wow.
So I actually posted that as a blog story somewhere along the line. But here was Connie, who grew up and experienced the industrial schools, and then at the same time she had the circumstance with her mother having a similar experience to baby Florence. So that was really, when I heard this, wow, we're really connected in a couple of ways here. It's amazing.
Yeah, a lot of these belief systems have carried over, and we don't know the origins of them. So that's why it's so important to have things like this out there to explain the history of it.
I think so. I think it's valuable.
So what are some of the other videos that you've done?
Oh, geez. Well, one that was fun I did recently was I interviewed the singer, the icon of the 60s or so, maybe 60s, I guess you could say, Judy Collins.
Yeah.
And I created the group I belonged to, we honored her. So I got to interview Judy, and then I created a video on her life. So that was fun, and that was shown at a big event in New York City a few weeks back. And I did the Breathing of an Ancestor, Space and Time, about my grandfather in the firehouse. I did one about my grandfather in a reform school. That was a different grandfather. I've done one about my father and me related to baseball.
Yeah, I love that one. That was so great.
Yeah, thank you. I did one about my finding my mother's grandfather's home, or my great-grandfather's home in Castle Blaney, Ireland. I did one, actually, one I was just looking at today, because today is Veterans Day, and I'll probably repost this one tomorrow. It's the story of, I think we'll call it, Images of War, Stories and Song. And I was taking a look at how we view World War II through these nostalgic songs and pictures, these interesting pictures of people, the nurse kissing the sailor in Times Square, and the Iwo Jima flag raising, and
yep.
I compare that to how Vietnam is perceived very, very, very differently. So that was actually and I had a number of friends who were actually killed in Vietnam. I have, my high school had 15 kids killed in Vietnam.
Wow.
And four or five of them I knew really well. So I've done a bunch. I guess I've done about 10 or 12, and I'm always thinking of a new project. I always have a few on the back burner that I'm working on, and I enjoy doing that.
I kind of like, in my own way, explore different things. And it never ends up where you think you're heading to begin with. And, you know, you kind of stumble on a piece of magic, and you just start exploring it. And next thing you know, you're in worlds that you never knew even existed.
That's a good point. I think the key, you know, if you talk to writers and filmmakers a lot, is letting that moment, you know, wash over you and going with
yes.
it. You know, it's getting yes. that feeling like, oh, you know, geez, this is going off in this direction. I didn't anticipate that, but you know what? Do it. Go there.
Definitely follow the energy of the story itself, because I think
I agree with you.
I've always thought that the message itself had the power to help you tell it. If you listen to it, it kind of
yes.
pulls you where you need to go and gives you the pieces that you would never find by yourself. So I almost see it as another person helping me.
Yeah, it's like the muse or whatever. You know, we use different words for these things.
Yeah.
But yes, it's following it. And my business partner back when, he was musical, but he didn't write. And when I'd be writing or whatever, and he would just always say to me, just trust the process. Trust the process. And, you know, so I came to, and I think of that, I think of him saying that all the time when I'm doing something, if I'm bogged down, just keep going. Put the pencil on paper. Put your fingers on the keyboard. Just keep going. Trust the process. And I find it works. It happens. You know?
Well, with you so in tune to the energy of a moment and the music that goes with it and everything, you're going to have a pull that most people wouldn't. So it's definitely important for you to follow the energy of it.
And well, just, I try.
Yeah, and you're doing a fantastic job with it.
Thank
now,
you.
So do you have a real sense of honor or duty toward things?
Sense of honor or duty toward things.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a lot for you to honor. I mean, these are trips you're taking, everything else to honor people's space and time. It takes a lot of sense of belonging and being part of something to create that much action.
Well, that's interesting. I never thought of it quite that way, but now that you say it that way, I guess so. I mean, you know, like I said again before, sometimes I'm, like I said before, sometimes I'm not sure what this is all about. You know, is it a sense of honoring the pain? I think so much of it is connection. I think that's the word, that I need to find connection, feel connected, and that doing that gives me a better sense of who and what I am. So there's always this strong feeling of who and what am I connected to, because when I know that, it gives me a better understanding of myself.
Okay.
So
it's a full circle moment in a lot of ways.
What's that?
It's a full circle moment in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah.
And brings them to life for you.
Oh, it's a very important, yeah, and doing that, you know, so... That's it. It's that the word connection. I mean, I sat down one day and I was going through this exercise. I had read somewhere, keep writing words down till you think you get to the word that is the most important word to you, or, you know, the word that's motivating you. And I,
right.
You know, you write love and peace and family and honor, and I get to the word connection. And every time I got to the word connection, I couldn't get a better word to get a sense of who I am or what's important to me. That word is probably the most important word that represents so much of who I am and what I do.
If somebody's listening, they'd like to bring their family to life the way you brought yours to life, where would they begin?
What I would say is, I mean, pick a person who they're really interested in, or maybe even better, pick a story that they've heard. And I'm kind of making this up on the fly here, and maybe they heard some story that's been going on for 30, 50, 100 years, and just take that and work around that. You know, if you heard of something that happened in the year, another story that I came upon, and I'll give this example, was I was looking for some material about my firefighter grandfather's life, who was born in 1904, and I determined to look into that. And I learned that right around the time he was born, and I was looking at New York papers to see if I could find something that happened around 116th Street on the east side of Manhattan. Well, lo and behold, I learned that a ship called the General Slocum, which was a big old paddle wheeler, was taking 1,000 people from a church on the Lower East Side into the Long Island Sound on a picnic. The boat caught on fire, and over 1,000 people, mostly women and children, were killed.
Wow.
Now, the connection there, when I started looking into that, is the man who they thought started the fire, his name was John Coakley. And I had a great-great-grandfather named John Coakley who had a son, John Coakley. And I said, this can't be. This could not be. This is unbelievable. So I start researching it. I find out, and the name was John J. Coakley. That was the name they gave in the Times. And my great-granduncle was John J. Coakley. I started researching that. There were two in the city. I ended up pursuing this, speaking to someone who wrote the book, sitting down and going through all these files and finding the address. And it wasn't my great-granduncle. It was the other fella in New York. But what it did was, it just created an amazing story, and it took me off. I had never heard of the General Slocum before that. Most Americans haven't. It's one of the biggest tragedies ever to happen in the United States, and people have never heard of it. And it taught me a great deal, and it also gave me a sense of when my grandfather was born, what was going on. So, you know, to answer your question, pick a story and just go with it and start researching it and learn what was going on and talk to your ancestors or talk to your ancestors, talk to your relatives. Find a death certificate or a birth certificate maybe related to that, and just start piecing it together and let your, as we were saying before, let it take you wherever it takes you.
Right.
You'll probably come up with something really interesting.
Is there any tricks on the internet that you've come across in researching that may help people?
Well, you know, there are a lot of sites you can go to now, a lot of genealogy sites. I think Cindy's is the big one. And there's another one. I can't think of the name of it right now. It's become very
Ancestry.com, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So now you can go to all these places and find census material. You really can find an enormous amount just by going to, you type in Cindy's, I think it's Cindy's Genealogy, Ancestry.com, and just go from there. I mean, actually, I didn't, when I first started doing this, it wasn't as popular on the internet. So a lot of what I was doing was sitting in archives. Now you can do so much of that online.
Right.
Which is really a hell of a lot easier. So, you know, that's what I would do is I would find one of those sites that curates, and again, I think Cindy's Genealogy is the name of one, that curates all of the different sites. I mean, you can get shipping records now through Ellis Island and Castle Garden. You can really just go on there and type in anything. And,
wow.
You know, it's directed. It's amazing.
Before we close, I want to make sure everybody knows how to find you again and your work. Can you tell us again how to locate you?
Sure. The I had actually changed the name of my blog to The Salon, S-A-L-O-N, so I'm sure if you typed in The Salon and my name, Charles Hale, you'll find that. But in addition to that, the email address, this is actually the, not the email, the
website. Yeah.
The website tag that you use is www.storiesconnectloveheals.com, and that will take you to my salon blog. And then if you go to YouTube and type in Charles R. Hale, H-A-L-E, you'll go to my YouTube page, and all the videos I've done, which I think are 10 or 12, they're also there as well. So
they're all great.
Thank you. Yeah, they're both sites. And I'll have another one coming out shortly.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. And you're always back here to tell the stories. I just find it so fascinating. And thank you again for honoring your family history and connecting us to Ireland and their truth as well.
Thank you, Nell. I appreciate it very much.
All right. You have a wonderful evening. Good night, everyone.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good.